Hey, welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John. How's it going, Steve?
I'm doing well, John. How are you?
Good, good. What have you been seeing in the world of FinTech lately?
Great question. So I had a really cool story today about the fact that Square now is worth half of Wells Fargo, and it's been in business for maybe 5 or 6 years. So the valuation
5 or 6 years?
I
Has it only
think
been?
so. I think it's only
Oh.
been, yeah, it's only been a few years.
There's so many things where they're so integral so quickly, you think they've just been around forever.
I think it's a testament to their product, right? But they are basically, I think their market cap now is $55 billion, which is only $20 billion less than Goldman Sachs.
Wow. Yeah. Out of nowhere, and they're taking on the big guys. Goldman Sachs is a G-SIB, a globally systemically important bank.
Too big to fail, yeah.
Too big to fail. And Square is catching up to them. Well, I'm less impressed with being half of the value of Wells Fargo since they're going down all the time. Soon, anybody will be worth some good portion or more than Wells Fargo.
Yeah, so they actually cut their dividend as well. So yeah, it's I guess that's not a good yardstick to measure yourself against
Your success.
your success. Yeah, absolutely.
I tell my mom I'm doing much better than my second cousin who's in jail. I remind her of that all the time. And all of the fintechs that have been around for a little while now are starting to grow up. But I was still surprised to see that SoFi is applying to be a nationally chartered bank.
It seems like they're going through that rebunding process now. They're applying for a second national banking charter as well, which would have all sorts of benefits, but also all sorts of drawbacks, right? They have a higher regulatory burden, but they can also set lower interest rates. It's kind of a mixed bag, but I think it speaks to the fact that now SoFi really wants to become basically, and they are going to be basically a bank now, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, they won't have to give away some of their margin to somebody else. And this is important for another reason. It's the kind of bank that they're applying to be. Like you said, an OCC national charter. What a lot of fintechs are trying to do is get an ILC, which is the industrial charter. It's a little bit lower bar, and it doesn't have all the abilities that national charter has. And of course, the higher regulatory bar of that national charter. So this can't be cheap for SoFi, but they must see the payoff. Well, yeah, there's a lot of different angles on fintech for sure. And here this week, we're lucky to have David Doerr, the managing principal at Doerr Asset Management and the founder of Coral Global Inc. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Appreciate being here.
Yeah, first, I guess just tell us about yourself a little bit and what's going on with Doerr Asset and Coral Global.
Sure, my pleasure. Well, so in my background's 25 years in capital markets. My career started from the perspective of trading commodities. I grew up in the Midwest in Missouri, and started trading commodities there. And in 2001, my brother and I moved to Miami with the intention to set up a global macro hedge fund. And we thought we were going to be the next George Soros and Jim Rogers. And we were a little ahead of our skis there. But we ended up getting recruited in Miami into the financial sector there at the time when insurance and capital markets were first coming together. And this was a really unique time and led to my brother and I starting our first fintech company in 2004, which was a company called Life Exchange. And Life Exchange was an electronic trading platform for the life insurance industry. We were the first and subsequently grew to become the largest, serving all institutional clients. And after the last financial crisis in 08, 09, we set up a multifamily office, which is what Doerr Asset Management is today. And Doerr Asset Management is a multifamily office focused on serving Latin American families. And our specialty, my career specialty, is dealing with investments as they relate to global macroeconomics, which is an important theme that we'll talk a little bit about with Coro. And then 2.5 years ago, we set up our second fintech company, which is called Coro. And Coro is a global money transmitter focused on the way that money moves across borders, but also bringing back real stable money, not Bitcoin, not crypto, not anything else, but actually bring gold back as a currency that can be used in the system. So that's what we're up to, and just kind of a quick background for you.
Okay, so this is kind of interesting with Coral Global. So using DLT technology, the blockchain, as a secure backend, but you're trading, you're a platform for trading gold?
Yeah, here's how it works. So we spent the last decade really keenly watching the different iterations that were taking place in distributed ledger technology. And I first want to frame this that distributed ledger technology is it's a good umbrella term. And blockchain and DLT get used interchangeably, but more specifically, blockchain is a type underneath DLT. It's a type of distributed ledger technology. There is a separate type, which is called directed acyclic graph. And of those, there's a particular version called Hashgraph, which is what we use. And we developed a very, very, very concrete thesis as far as what we felt would be necessary for DLT to evolve all the way from Bitcoin and Ethereum and as it grew. And about 3 years ago, there was a big breakthrough with Hashgraph and a computer scientist named Dr. Lehman Baer, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant gentleman, along with his partner, Mance Harmon. And they solved a lot of the issues that were taking place in being able to scale blockchain solutions and other DLT solutions. And when we saw that, we knew that it was an enormous breakthrough. And if we could use that ledger for all our reconciliation for financial transactions, we'd have a huge commercial advantage. So when we talk about DLT, we use it for real-time settlement, which is our focus, because payments cross borders are ridiculously slow. This is some of the things that you're seeing SWIFT try to tackle, as well as a lot of the big banks.
So essentially for a consumer, what is the benefit of using the Coral technology to take part in the gold market here?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there's three specific things that our technology does that's a differentiator. Number one, by being able to facilitate real-time settlement, and we'll just set gold to the side just for a moment, because we process fiat transactions as well. So dollars, we're working on our license in Mexico right now, so very soon Mexican pesos as well. But when we look at the settlement backlog for transactions, whether those are equities or in our version dealing with currencies, there's an average settlement time of 2 days. So you look at the 6 trillion plus notional traded currency market, it's a T plus two market. So T meaning the trade date and the plus two meaning for 2 days settlement. This is crazy, right? This is 2020. It should be T plus a millisecond. Settlement and trade date should be almost simultaneous. However, this is very difficult to get to. So the first thing that our users experience is real-time settlement. So whether you're an institution or an individual and you just send in money between peers, when that money goes, it goes instantaneously and it settles instantaneous. It's not us providing some sort of credit or taking balance sheet risk when it moves from one customer account to another one. That's instant and final. That's the first thing. The second aspect is that there's a big backlog in the way that money transmitters work right now, in that most of them have limits on how much you can send. And the problem with this is it creates a very bifurcated market. So we have all these beautiful fintechs that are speeding up the way that we can transmit money and giving us all these great mobile apps. But the moment you got to do a large scale transaction, you get stuck back in the traditional banking system. Now, this is not really an issue as far as whether or not a money transmitter has the ability to move large sums. As a licensed money transmitter, you can move large sums just like a bank. The real differentiator is the compliance technology, making sure that you have the compliance tools to be able to vet and do due diligence on large scale transactions. And so when we built Coro, we knew that from day one, and we really unpacked all the processes that were going on with anti-money laundering and know your customer rules. And we completely redesigned the way that that's done. And that's very powerful for our customers. It's not just that you can move large transactions on our system. You can also onboard the unbanked. So this is really interesting, because money transmitters are really kind of stuck in a narrow field for who their customer base is. But if you can lower the cost of compliance, and let's take Mexico as an example. In Mexico, the greatest cost for somebody from, you know, lower socioeconomic class to get banking services, the cost is the cost of compliance for the bank. And so the banks don't open accounts. And on average in Mexico, that's $600-$800 in the first year. When you can lower that cost to pennies, you can now provide financial services and financial inclusion to, as the United Nations calls them, the unbanked. And unbanked is not just an issue in, you know, Mexico and emerging markets. It's an issue right in the United States. Some estimates are that 1 out of 5 Americans are unbanked or underbanked in some format. So that's the second advantage. And then the third piece is, here's where gold comes in. Right now, we have a little bit of historic amnesia as far as what money is. You know, money is a unit of account, a store of value, and a medium of exchange. And even in the context of gold, gold has really just been treated as a investable asset class. Even though under the Basel III standards, gold is treated as a tier one asset for banks internationally. Every major central bank in the world holds gold as part of its FX reserves. But for the average person, you can't really use gold as a currency. Use it in a commercial transaction, buy a coffee, split a pizza, dinner tab, or anything else. And so Coro brings that back so that you can use gold as easily and conveniently as you would dollars, euros, or anything else. It's not exclusive to gold. It's not exclusive to dollars. It just gives you that beautiful optionality.
I'm wondering, is there any difference in the way that gold has been either used? I know that gold is up over the past two quarters or so, but have you seen any difference in the way that your customers are using gold in light of COVID now? Because it seems like it's sort of the type of instrument that could be ripe for explosion in the current environment.
Absolutely. So our product actually rolls out here in the next 30 days. So 30 days from now, I'll have a great answer on that. I can speculate. We do certainly believe that what COVID is exposing is it's exposing the fragility of the financial system underneath. We're in the very late stages of a ginormous credit bubble. Last year, you guys may have seen this in some of the news, some charts circulated, the total number of outstanding developed market debt, you know, across Europe, Japan, the United States, and elsewhere, with negative yields, it surpassed $17 trillion. This is why gold has been ticking up. Last year, gold set a new high versus every currency in the world, with the exception of the dollar. And this year, it's up quite a bit. It was 1,800 something an ounce this morning. It's only about $75 an ounce away from setting a brand new high in US dollars. And COVID is just making people more cognizant of that as they see all the printing that's being done by governments around the world to help try and revive the global economy. So yes, I think that we'll see a considerable uptick in experimentation as we roll out. People are going to want to see what it's like to be able to transact in gold versus a regular paper currency.
What is the mechanism via which a user can actually use gold as a currency as opposed to a fiat currency?
Part of our mission is to really re-educate folks on the value of gold and how it played a role as money. And what's interesting about this history that I'll share with you and your audience today is that when we look at currency codes, currency code for the dollar is USD. We're all familiar with that. We see it. Let's take something else familiar, the euro. That's EUR. So every country has got a three-letter currency code. That's set in Switzerland by the International Standards Organization. What most people don't know, however, is that there happens to be a three-letter currency code for gold. It's XAU. Gold, silver, platinum, and palladium are the only things that are not made of paper that actually have an identifiable currency code. So we're not reinventing the wheel here. We're just bringing back to kind of the foreground for people to understand how to think in terms of gold as currency. And fortunately, there's a great format for that. So XAU equals one troy ounce. When you hear about the price of gold, you're hearing about the number of dollars that it takes to buy one troy ounce or to buy and purchase one XAU. So that experience for our customers, the easiest way to visualize it is imagine that you have a mobile app and it's like a savings account and you've got a multiple currency account. If you wanted to save some of your money in dollars, some of it in euros, and some of it in XAU, which is gold, that's how it appears on your account screen. So when you download our app, it allows you to connect into the US banking system. We're licensed at the federal and the state level. And it allows you to connect your bank account. You're able to move that money over. And once your money's in your Coro account, that's where it starts to speed up. So if I wanted to send dollars from my Coro account to your Coro account, I click a button, boom, it debits my side, credits your side, the transaction's done. Now, if I have one troy ounce in my account and I want to send that to you, the process is the same, and this is where we use the power of the ledger. But the question then arises, well, how do I get from my dollars into gold? So let's say I don't have gold yet in my account, but I would like to exchange some of my dollars for gold. Well, very much like you would in any other type of currency exchange, except with the difference is this is all in your mobile phone and at your fingertips, you can transact at the live spot rate, and you can exchange however many dollars for however many XAUs you please. And it's instantaneous. We handle that transaction. And again, we use that DLT to settle it. So there's a ton of stuff going on in the background, tons. We have all the reconciliation. We have all the redundancies that have to be there to triple quadruple check that reconciliation. We have, we're piped into FX dealers. We're piped into our gold dealer. It's real physical gold. This is not a claim on gold. That's something else that was very important in the way that we designed this. It's full legal title. So when you see gold in your account, that is your gold. You can press a button and that gold will be delivered to your door if you choose to have it withdrawn. So that's a little bit about how it works.
Oh, and you said this would be in available in the U.S. in 30 days?
That's correct.
Waiting for some compliance or regulatory approval?
We've got our federal money business service license that we got last year. We got our Florida license, our Arizona license, five other states, and we've got another 15 that are rolling in over the next 3-4 weeks. So we want to have kind of a critical mass to have enough states to roll out at the same time. But we estimate releasing here at the end of this month, and it'll be available in all those states where we're licensed. And as we keep adding states, we'll roll out in those additional states. And then probably December, we'll release in Mexico.
And you're looking for the consumer individual level adoption, not like a business or larger fund kind of thing, right?
That's an important distinction. So because we look at rebuilding the underlying rails underneath, we see this as a payment ecosystem that will serve all types of participants, including institutions. The obvious market entry point, the lower hanging fruit, is to enter at the peer-to-peer level. And so that's where we're entering the market. We'll roll out the commercial version next year, but we have all the intention to provide commercial transactional services. And that was our background. My background was serving financial institutions in particular and dealing with the complexity of having those types of those customers. So we want to kind of handle the whole gamut.
So with all the questions that, let's say, initial coin offerings have had, crowdsourcing, mm-hmm. fraud, that sort of thing, what's your plan for getting it out there and overcoming those kinds of concerns?
Compliance is a big part of our team's background. We have backgrounds with international compliance and moving capital and securitizations and derivatives. So we're used to this regulatory world. And what we did to help give confidence to our customer base out the gate was we wanted to make sure that there was really clear transparency across everything that we were doing. So we're actually a public company. We're traded on the OTC markets right now. I don't know if you guys saw our filing, but we're doing an IPO also this month and going on to NASDAQ. So awesome. That makes us, it's pretty cool. We're really excited about that. That makes us triple regulated in the US. It would be unusual for a startup company to go waste all the money of being a public company out the gate. But for us, because I'm a fiduciary over at our asset management business, and I have so much more comfort with liquid markets and the transparency that they provide, it was important that we did that so that we could show that from day one. So we got the blessing of the SEC as far as our business model. You see that with our S-1 statement that went effective. So we're regulated by the SEC, regulated by Department of Treasury, regulated at the state level, and then there's regulations in each country that we go into. That's pretty heavy-duty stuff. In addition to that, you guys might actually know about this. I've said this several times. I think we're the first fintech to ever have a SOC 2 certification before doing a customer transaction. You guys might know different, but so far I haven't heard of anybody else doing it. SOC 2 certification is a major cybersecurity audit. We spent $250,000 on that. That's not something you can do overnight. It takes a lot of time and network infrastructure. And just showing our commitment to cybersecurity, it's absolutely deep roots in the way that we're building and providing a transparency on this company, because it's the only way that you can be around for a long time.
Oh, got it. So is it a big marketing push at the beginning, or do you have some kind of built-in user base that you can tap?
Yeah, it's interesting. So we have a little, it's both. It is both. It's a pretty significant marketing push out the gate. And it's also leveraging the community that we have. Coro's headquartered in Miami. And what's particularly interesting about that, with Miami effectively being the northern capital of South America, is that there's a lot better understanding of what it means to live through and try and survive during a currency crisis. In Miami, we have approximately 200,000 Venezuelans that live there. And when you start talking about using a more reliable currency or something that has more certainty to it, such as gold, this is something that resonates. So we feel that we have a lot of leverage through the Latin American community in Miami, and we think that that's going to be significant for us as we launch. And our intention as well is to get into Venezuela this year and provide our services there. Venezuela was a lot of the inspiration for this business to begin with. So those are some very low cost ways and real high multiple client acquisition for us. At least that's our goal. That's how it looks in our head.
Wow, that's pretty neat. Yeah, I think I've actually seen online maybe the photos of all the people in Venezuela making purses out of their currency, because it's just so worthless.
That's right.
So yeah, so I think this is solving a pretty interesting problem there. Why hasn't this been done before? It seems like it's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because it's not a, some people are like, oh, this makes so much sense. It's not an original idea. It's not like we woke up and we've created something brand new. We took the discipline from being career executives and knowing how to execute and deal with really complex, expensive financial things. But the concept itself is actually pretty practical. You know, paper money evolved from it being just too impractical to carry gold around physically because it was heavy, it's dense. And that's how paper currency came about. But we've gravitated away so fast since 1971, when we went off the gold standard in the United States, everybody's just forgotten. If you look at the volatility in asset classes, not just equities, but if you look at the volatility across asset classes and all the weird instruments that have had to be created since we went off the gold standard to mitigate risk, the root cause of that, we're doing all this kind of patchwork of treating symptoms, but not the underlying cause. It's because we have unstable money, really, really, really unstable. There's nothing anchoring it. And, you know, we're past to the point we've got new generations. They don't even know what that looks like. I was born in 77. So after we had already come off the gold standard, I had to read about it in the history books. And I think that as we go into this, you know, much deeper crisis, that it's going to come back with a vengeance, and people are going to say, hey, this is logical. How do we ever leave this? And I really sincerely, you know, believe that that's what's going to happen. And we want to be there to democratize access to it.
Is there any concern with maybe the price of gold fluctuating more than, say, the US dollar or the euro?
Yes. So let me share my perspective with you guys in the audience as far as how we look at the price of gold. Because there's a couple different ways to think about this when we're looking at currencies. Currencies, unlike a stock, you're really looking at something vis-a-vis, you know, one currency versus another. Dollars versus euros, gold versus dollars. What's interesting is that we tend to look at gold as if gold is the volatile component, but it's actually the dollars that are volatile versus gold. And here's how we know. 1 troy ounce of gold is exactly the same as it was 5,000 years ago. A troy ounce is the standard unit. It doesn't change. And what's interesting to note is that if you had 1 troy ounce of gold during the Roman Empire, they would buy you one of the nicest togas and one of the nicest dinners in the city. If you took 1 troy ounce today, it'd buy you one of the nicest suits and one of the nicest dinners in any major city in the world today. So it's held and it's possessed, it's maintained its purchasing power. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't get a lot of fluctuation with how many dollars will equal 1 troy ounce of gold. Those things do move around. And when you get to the late stage of a currency collapse, it moves around a lot. And what happens is ultimately, you know, dollars become worthless and gold goes sky high in paper terms. And we're going to see that. That's history's a great barometer of how these play out. Over 3,800 currencies that were fiat, they all crashed, all of them, 100% failure rate. So it's a real thing. And we tell people, listen, you need to understand it. If you want to put your savings in this, if you're going to be transacting and selling tacos and for gold, you need to understand that, you know, the world has volatility being introduced. And this is a way to mitigate it, but it doesn't mean that it eliminates it.
Yeah, so your product is just making that more viable than carrying on the little pouches of gold and weighing it and all that. So it becomes kind of in the patchwork of available kinds of currencies, right? You know, you have multi fiat currencies. You have you know, some people swear by Ethereum, or they mm-hmm. swear at Ripple.
Right.
And then that's right. You'll have a gold in there. I kind of think of it as and some of them are good for different purposes, right? So I kind of see this as something that's very helpful, and it's going to have its use cases to, you know, maybe like you said, for security or for long-term holdings. And then you're switching in and out of other things. So is there some thought to making kind of a multi-currency wallet or multi-commodity wallet where you can take your gold into cryptocurrency, into
platinum,
foreign currencies, into whatever you need to do it? Because not everyone's going to accept Coral for, you know, it's just everything that has a different purpose.
Yeah, that's right. So we have maybe a unique view on that. I think we stand a little bit alone in the forest with our view and our thesis, and we'll see how this plays out. We're not going to offer any access to cryptocurrencies. We have a really, really strong opinion on technologically and economically the way that they're structured. We think they're all flawed, every single one of them out there, and significantly flawed. So being a career trader, you know, if there were better opportunity and I didn't think there was so much manipulation on the crypto exchanges, I would be short, you know, every cryptocurrency out there. But there is a lot of manipulation is one of the errors. We will be providing, so 100%, our business model is to provide gold alongside any recognized fiat currency. So every country that we're licensed in will offer the domestic currency and gold. And we will make a market and make that liquidity there. As an example, in Mexico. In Mexico, there's no active market to switch from Mexican pesos to gold. There's no convenient way to do that. However, with our app, that will be just smooth as butter. You'll be able to go from pesos to dollars, dollars to gold, pesos to gold, whatever you want, or holding balances in all three. So fiat currency and anything that would have an ISO currency code.
So the user experience makes sense. It seems like a very viable product. What is your business model then?
So our business model is first addressing where there's need for stability and there's deterioration in the purchasing power of the currency. And right now, COVID is showing that that's for sure countries external to the U.S. because the U.S. still has its place with as reserve currency kingpin of the world. But when we look at exchange rates in Latin America, in Colombia, in Brazil, in Mexico, and throughout the rest of the world, there's been major, even Canada and Australia, we're seeing double-digit shifts in exchange rates with really, really, really high volatility. We see focusing on LATAM clients that are in the United States as a starting point, as well as Americans. There's millions and millions of Americans that own gold, that have saved gold, but they have never been able to transact with gold. So whether somebody wants to buy gold and just have that as savings and not transact with it, we now make it easy for them. A lot of my friends, they ask me, they're like, hey, I want to own gold. Where do I get it? Do I got to go to the pawn shop to get it? Do I got to buy it from some online website? You know, I don't have a brokerage account right now. Like, what's the easiest way to get it? A lot of people just don't know how to buy it. So in America, that's a really wide audience, and we'll be able to serve them immediately right out the gate. Strategically, though, we're looking at those cases where it becomes very important to have something that's stable. And so here's something that may surprise you guys. If we look at the remittance flow between the United States and Mexico, and depending on whose statistics you're using, that's between $25 to $40 billion in one-way flow from the United States, dollars being converted into Mexican pesos on an annual basis. This is a huge, huge amount of currency flow. What's fascinating is that the single largest month for money remittance from families in the United States sending money back home to families in Mexico, the largest month for that ever was March during the peak of the crisis.
Wow. Now,
amazing, right? Very counterintuitive. I even put together a little article on this I'm happy to share with you guys, talking about how migrant workers are actually amazing currency traders. The reason that there was so much flow is because families in the United States were taking advantage of the sell-off in the Mexican peso versus the dollar. And it was a better time to send more money back home, not only because family members in Mexico needed it, but because the dollars would convert over to many more Mexican pesos than they had previously. This is fascinating to me because people don't think, we think in terms of currency traders as people in their bedroom speculating or big investment banks trading currency flows. But after my experience, I used to have a foundation for Venezuela. My experience there was everybody's a currency trader. everybody, you know, the people that work as gardeners and work at newspaper stands to big executives and government officials, everybody's a currency trader. So giving those communities something reliable, we think matters. And we think we'll have an adoption rate that's unique. So that's our focus out the gate.
That absolutely makes sense. Yeah. One of the other businesses that you have is you run an asset management company based out of the Cayman Islands, right? Or in Colombia?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, we're headquartered and regulated out of the Cayman Islands. But we have an office in Mexico, Miami, and in Colombia.
So are you making kind of complementary investments through that to support the coral business? Or are they completely separate where you see just good opportunities?
Yeah, that's a great question. So where they're related is twofold. They're related at the top level as far as that our background is in global macroeconomics. That's my career background, hence my sentiment around gold and financial crises. So that's our view, and that's why we built Coro. We wanted to make sure that there was a real solution to the next financial crisis that didn't leave anybody out, that would be accessible to anybody. So thematically, that's what ties those businesses together. They're also tied together in that it's not a coincidence that when we founded Coro, it made sense just dealing with our own customer and clientele base. We put over $7 million amongst our family office and friends into Coro. So we funded and seeded the company and put all the capital into it to date. And that's obviously, you know, because we run an asset management business, so we're in a good position to do that. From there, they're totally different businesses after that. One manages assets, the other one's a fintech.
Okay, so what are you seeing on the door asset management side that's exciting?
What's exciting to me is I think that there's massive disconnects in markets, which are creating some, I don't want to be so extreme as to say a once-in-a-lifetime type trades, but significantly disconnected markets. A fantastic example of this that's visible and relatable is looking at Tesla. Tesla crossing over $1,400 per share. I think they crossed $1,500 per share today. Amazing and completely ridiculous. Totally. Yeah, totally
I sold at 300, so I'm.
Yeah.
I'm myself.
Yeah. Don't feel bad. That was an inappropriate exit point. So there's big disconnects, and these are symptomatic of late stage credit cycles. We also see, so you get a big blowout in equities. Equities are mispriced. They're mispriced to the moon. They're just completely ridiculously too high pretty much all around the world. There's always exceptions, but generalized. Bonds, even worse. They're completely ridiculous. There was a 100-year bond sold in Austria paying, I believe it was paying 85 basis points. Can you imagine lending the Austrian government money for 100 years and you're going to get a coupon of 85 basis points per year? That's it. And you're taking all that principal risk during a century.
My grandchildren would be upset with me. Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy. So we see that like the first quarter with the crisis, we had an amazing first quarter. We were pretty much short the world. There's going to be really good opportunity in commodities. Commodities versus equities are so stretched apart. The commodities are going to be a really interesting place to be, we think, over the next, you know, 10 and 20 years. And then there's going to be a lot of really cool, you'll have to filter through a bunch of stuff, but most exciting is looking at what's on the other side of this gigantic financial crisis that we're going to enter. On the other side of it is a lot of beautiful stuff, we think. I think that you're going to see ESG strategies and many, 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 many more sustainable companies come out doing a lot of neat stuff. So those are the things that we're looking at, but there's a lot going on in everything and across all asset classes.
Well, what about any specific fintech trends that you notice?
Well, fintech's awesome, right? I love it. I'm in the space. I think the elephant in the room, or maybe it's, I think everybody knows it. The valuations are crazy. I think they're just ridiculously high. And, yep. It's one thing to be a beneficiary of that. At the same time, you gotta think in terms of, you know, what are you creating and do you really intend to be around for the long term? One of the things that disturbs me about the fintech path right now, or what's trending, what's popular, is that you have this notion, fintechs are, I see a lot of them behaving like, they're like social media companies, right? It's how many customers do you have, not are you actually even making money? And this to me is perplexing, because having run my last company as a fintech business, fintech is something that should be relatively a straightforward path to profits on the bottom line. Like if you can't direct that relatively quick as a company, chances are something's really way off. You're scaling way too fast. You're blowing way too much money. And you know, I look around and not naming any names, I see a ton of that. I look at these cap raises. I'm like, oh my God, what are they doing with the money? How are they not truly legitimately, you know, just printing real profits and tons of them at this point? But again, guys, this is also emblematic of late stage credit cycles. And it just happens to be fintech is one of the hot sectors. And there's always hot sectors at late stages. And fintech's one of them this time.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the VCs, I think, Steve, you were just saying how the fundings had hardly gone down through the first half of this year compared to last year. And maybe that speaks to just the VCs have to keep investing. They can't sit on that cash.
Well, I was just going to mention, I think there's something else going on that's also really toxic across venture capital and just funding cycles in general. Really,
oh, I love
really,
it.
Really
Go ahead. Toxic.
Yeah, it's really toxic. It's that you're seeing these inflated rounds, and you know, it's the type of stuff that SoftBank does, right? And SoftBank's not alone in this. It's not singling them out. But you have these firms and they're inflating these values through additional rounds, and they pump up the rounds intentionally. That's toxic. That doesn't do anybody any good. And not that that never happened before, but it just seems a lot worse and more persistent this time. You're seeing founders come in and participate in really high valuation rounds. And that's being billed as, oh, look at the founder. They believe in this valuation and they're putting money in at this crazy high round. But it's BS. It's just really to gimmick that higher round. And on a cumulative basis, they're of course worth much more. I think that's really dishonest. And it's not healthy for markets.
Good perspective to keep in mind. And yeah, mm-hmm. It's clearly that's happening with the valuations. And yeah, SoftBank is not the only one, but they are our favorite one to beat up on.
Understandably so.
So you're also working with the USC Incubator. What's going on there?
Yeah, that's been a recent opportunity. One of the things that I realized over the last couple of years I wasn't carving out enough time for was to just to be a sounding board for other entrepreneurs. I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. And unlike a lot of smart entrepreneurs that have chosen good mentors along the way, frankly, I didn't have any. And that was my own error. It's not that they didn't exist or that I couldn't have found good ones. I just shied away from it. And I think I bumped my head against the wall a lot more than was necessary by taking that longer path. And so 2 years ago, I made the commitment to make myself more available to incubators and universities to be a sounding board or just share my experience to the extent that it would be valuable for students or new entrepreneurs.
Oh, great. Yeah. Some of the giving back and some guidance on the next generation. Not that you're that old, but.
Gen X.
Yeah. Viva Gen X. I'm for
that's
that.
Right.
Great. Yeah. Thank you. That's David Doerr, the managing principal at Doerr Asset Management and the founder of Coral, C-O-R-O, Global Inc., and a mentor at the USC Incubator. Thanks for listening, and please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news. See you next week.